Welcome to Solace, a podcast about global health problems and solutions. Solace brings together locals and researchers, doctors, anthropologists, artists and activists. They co-create knowledge, stories and artwork around public healthcare in the Philippines. Welcome to a new episode of the Solace podcast.
Hello everyone, a very warm welcome to this Solace podcast. I am Frances Gibson, one of the Solace student ambassadors from Keele University Medical School, and I am so happy to be able to share a little bit about my wonderful experience in Northern Samoa with you. Now, there is so much to talk about from what I observed and learned in Samoa, but I'm just going to pick up on a few things that really stuck out to me. That's going to be things like the way that culture impacts health, issues surrounding poverty and resources, mental health, and the rich spirituality of the people I met and their strong sense of community. So I went to the Philippines, particularly interested in the social determinants of health. Now, that's obviously extremely broad-based because it encompasses pretty much everything in a person's life, and all of those factors are interconnected. So there's so many different elements that you can look at, which is why it's just so interesting to me. And what better way is there really to understand something so multifactorial than to live in that reality? So ethnography is, of course, the perfect way really to understand something so big and so vast, and to begin to understand the habitus of people. You've heard the saying, to fully understand someone, you need to walk a mile in their shoes. And that's pretty much what we did. So as ethnographers, we lived in Samoa, in the homes of local people, and we were able to learn about their daily routines, their likes and dislikes, their hopes and desires, their norms, their values, also their spiritual and religious beliefs, and kind of try and learn the intricacies of their culture. So from the offset, in some ways you might think ethnography sounds quite simple or straightforward. Oh, you just need to be with people, observe them, learn about them. You know, what's difficult about that? But there's actually so much more to it than that, and it truly is an art. And that's because such simple things in everyday life can be overlooked and missed, and they might actually be integral to understanding something else. So you really must be so open and observant when you do an ethnography. And once you do open your eyes, there is so much to see. And you've heard people say it's in the details. And that phrase, it's in the details, is so true, because it is the small things you see everywhere, every day. I kind of like to think of it like millions of little jigsaw pieces that you gather one at a time. And when you assemble them all together, they create the whole picture of a person and of their health. It was Joel Canudai from Solace who actually said, ethnography is seeing the extraordinariness of ordinary things, which I just love that phrase. So these tiny little jigsaw pieces allow us to make sense of something much greater. There's a quote from Roald Dahl, and I love Roald Dahl, and it says, above all, watch with glittering eyes the whole world around you, because the greatest secrets are always hidden in the most unlikely places. Those who don't believe in magic will never find it. And I agree, the most astonishing or moving or interesting moments of the trip were hidden in plain sight. So now I want to paint the picture of what it was like in Samoa. Try and have a flashback and take you there with me. So there was kind of this intense heat that hit us as soon as we arrived, and the streets were flooded with colour. There was bright orange tricycles whizzing around. There was a vast overflowing greenery from these big great trees. There was lush green grass. There was market stalls selling fish, bread, fruit, you name it. The houses that lined the roads often had large leaves on the roofs, and these leaves blew slightly in the breeze, which was very nice. There was children walking along the roadside. Sometimes they weren't accompanied, which was quite different to what we'd see in the UK. The people along the roadside that walked, some of them carried umbrellas that were brightly coloured to shade themselves from the sun. There was dogs trotting along the roadside. The more built-up areas were just packed with life and with noise, overflowing at the seams. That's all I can describe it as. It was really wonderful to be immersed in it. And then in the slightly less built-up areas, there were still cats, chickens, pigs, people laughing and joking, children were singing. So, yeah, that's kind of the setting. And on top of that, obviously, then we get to talk to the people, which is where it gets really interesting. So it was fascinating for me to learn of the spiritual beliefs of the people in Samoa. Many of the people told me, for example, things like trees house spirits. And they said things like, oh, don't walk over the roots. You don't know what's housed in there. So you could be possessed by the spirits that reside inside trees. And actually, I think it was about five people that I spoke to had themselves been possessed or had a close family member that had been possessed. They also had beliefs in monsters and creatures. One monster was described to me as having a long tongue and it would try and suck the baby out of the belly button of a pregnant mother. And to protect herself from this, she had to wear garlic around her neck to protect from it. I was also told about people who hex other people to make them ill. And I asked a few ladies what protects them from these kind of creatures, and they said the Holy Spirit. And this theme of the Holy Spirit and God and religion was something that kept cropping up throughout the trip. Almost everyone I met was religious. There was icons in every home, and even in the hospital there was icons. There was a big statue of Mary and rosary beads. And people made references to God when they spoke. They said that they go into the chapel when they're not well or when a family member isn't well. And so I think it seems that a lot of people had a great faith, and I think a lot of them found comfort in their faith as well. People also found healing in helots. Now, a helot is someone who's believed to be blessed with a gift, and they can soothe muscle aches and pains, such as those that commonly affected the fishermen and the labourers. And they're also sought for advice and assistance during pregnancy. A helot was a very respected figure in the community, and one person described the helot to me and they said, she can command a room full of people. And another person said, she delivered half of us. So I was fortunate enough to meet the helot and talk with her about her gift. She described her own hands as being like stethoscopes. She said she can place them on the mother's stomach and know things about the health of the baby. She told me that she'd learned this gift from her mother at the age of 16. Helots commonly delivered babies in the past, but they're now actually paid 300 pesos, and this is given to them as an incentive to bring mothers in labour into the hospital rather than attempting to deliver the baby themselves. However, the helot I spoke to actually told me that often when there are difficulties during pregnancies and during the labour, doctors will actually ask the helot to stay with them, stay with the mother during delivery, which I thought was really interesting. I wonder if it's maybe because of the mother's beliefs it might help calm her, or maybe it's due to the doctor's own beliefs. So that's quite interesting, I thought. These beliefs were so interesting to learn about. One thing that struck me so kind of head on was people's integration of nature into their daily lives. So this was not only in terms of their job with agriculture and fishing, but also in their health beliefs and health practices. For instance, many of the people talked about the healing properties of the sea. So for example, if they had a tight chest or a bad chest, they told me that the sea air would relieve it, so they'd kind of spend time near the sea. And men would often go for a swim in the water after circumcision to sterilise the wound. I was also told that people would often take family members to the sea for rehab following a stroke. So they would do movements in the water, like just gentle motions, to encourage the affected areas of the body to get going again with that little bit less resistance that the sea provides. People also used plants a lot, and this was just absolutely fascinating. It was something I'd written my dissertation on for my biology degree, and it was fantastic to get to meet people who are using medicinal plants in such a way. So everyone I spoke to pretty much had their own collection of medicinal plants, either in their garden, or if it wasn't in the garden, it was very nearby. For example, if you ask someone, what would you do for high blood pressure? They would say, boil some lemongrass, or boil garlic, or chew garlic, or boot your leaves. And there was just millions of herbal remedies that they knew for a lot of the common conditions that affected the area. So when I asked where they've learnt all these remedies and potions from, they would tell me that it was from their mother. So it kind of seems to be a source of knowledge that has passed down through the generations and kind of shared among communities. And I also spoke to one lady who told me she'd had an enlarged thyroid and needed surgery to remove part of it. But before she had the surgery, she was actually advised by an albulario, like a faith healer, to eat the head of a jellyfish. And she said she did, and her thyroid decreased in size to the point where she no longer needed the surgery, which I found fascinating. And that was just interesting to hear about, really. It's also very common for people to share plants with their neighbours if their neighbours are unwell. So they'll say, oh, you're unwell, I know what I can give you. And this brings me on to the importance of family and that strong sense of community that there was in Samoa. I spoke with people who described the role of families following a stroke in helping care for that family member when they kind of may have lost bodily functions or they just basically can't take care of themselves. And I remember asking someone, what if people don't have family? And the people would just look at me and shrug. And this kind of resonated with me because it highlighted the importance of informal care. This was also exemplified through Alzheimer's. So one lady told me that when older people become forgetful, their children take care of them. And she also said that there's nothing in place for those who don't have family to take care of them. And this is obviously saddening to hear. And in some ways, I saw similarities between the UK and Samoa in the way society was kind of organised. It was apparent how socioeconomic status impacted so much about a person's life, including their health. Most of the people I spoke to had non-communicable diseases, whether that was type 2 diabetes or hypertension, or they knew people who'd had strokes. There was this universal link between poverty and ill health. And pneumonia and urinary tract infections were also ubiquitous among those who were living below the poverty line, particularly affecting the young and the elderly. And living conditions were impacted in certain diseases, implicated in certain diseases, because there was this obvious rise in pneumonia in the rainy season. And living conditions obviously affect people's exposure to things like the weather. One barangay health worker told me that sometimes people share inhalers as well, which obviously influences the spread of disease. And there was also issues of overcrowding in the home, which affected the spread of diseases like TB and chest infections. There's obviously a lot of barriers that rural communities face when they're accessing care and treatment. Firstly, there's obviously the distance that they must travel to get to the hospital. One woman told me that she had to travel around 6 hours to get to the hospital that she'd been assigned to. And I spoke to many people who had to get a boat and a bus and sometimes even another bus to get to the hospital. And this obviously costs them money. So for those living below the poverty line, this often deters them from accessing care. I was told of one person who fell ill and was trying to gather the money they needed to get to the hospital. And after 24 hours, they got enough money together, but sadly they died before they actually got there. Another person said to me, people get very scared of going to the hospital, not about the diagnosis, but about the cost. And I thought that was sad, that the cost is actually what's scaring them rather than the diagnosis. Also, both the rural health unit and the hospital themselves as buildings had been affected by a typhoon that had happened a few years ago, and the damage that had been done hadn't been fixed. So those who work there had improvised with what they have. And also kind of, it was interesting to note the differences in paperwork. So in Samoa, in the hospital, there was a lot of paper files and there was kind of these massive stacks of paper on tabletops to prevent them being damaged by adverse weather. And similarly, the barangay health workers, who I was lucky enough to shadow, they kept their records on paper and they told me that this is problematic as they can be destroyed again by the weather. So there's some inconsistencies there. And they also said that when there's a new barangay captain appointed, kind of the politics will influence which barangay health workers are kept on. And so sometimes they can lose their job if their political views don't align with the barangay captains. And this, I thought, must impact the continuity of care because the barangay health workers get to know the people that they serve and they establish a rapport with them. And if new barangay health workers are brought in, following in the appointment of a new barangay captain, this must mean these relationships need to be rebuilt and everyone's kind of health problems must be relearned. It's also interesting to talk just briefly about kind of crimes and violence. One of the nights that we were in Samoa, a man came into the hospital with an axe wound to the back of the head, and we were told that violent crimes like this were common in this particular area. People, they said, are often admitted for gunshot wounds, stabs and slashes from knives or axes, and they said it's particularly following fiestas, which I wonder might be to do with potentially alcohol consumption, which is an interesting point about culture. I remember that there was a sign outside the desk actually at the hospital. As you first go in, there was a big statue of Mary, and then there was a sign on the desk by the guard, and it said, "Firearms or deadly weapons are not allowed inside. Please deposit your firearms with the guard on duty." And I just thought, this is very different. I've never seen a sign like that in the UK. I was also told about fires relating back to alcohol and fiestas. So fires can be quite common in road traffic accidents as well. And actually many of the women I spoke to had been remarried because their husbands had died, for example, in motorbike accidents, to name but a few of the causes of death. And these road traffic accidents were often due to the volume of traffic on the roads. The GP I interviewed had told me about that and said that these traffic accidents are often associated with mental health problems. Now that brings me on to mental health. Mental health was something that was brought up in every conversation I had with people, and almost everyone responded in the same way, which was quite interesting. They would kind of be slightly closed off and they'd say, "No one's depressed here," or "We don't have mental health problems here," or I think once someone said, "There's one person who is depressed, but they've experienced this amount of loss and trauma, but they're the only person that we know." And people would just close off to this mention of the phrase mental health. And it's just seemed that it's still a taboo. And even the majority of the Barangay health workers actually that I interviewed reacted in that same way. So I definitely got the vibe that there's still this issue of stigma, which I'd kind of heard about, but definitely saw myself. So families can keep people kind of hidden away. And there's this notion of the village crazy person. So these people can kind of be marginalised by society. And it was interesting, when I was interviewing a GP in the Philippines, he told me that there's 2 mental health hospitals in the entire Philippines, and there's 643 psychiatrists to 102,333,484 people. And he said that that is one psychiatrist to 200,000 people, which is quite shocking figures, really. And on our last day, still on the topic of mental health, I spoke to a nurse, and she was so knowledgeable about the mental health conditions that affected the area. She said that Parkinson's is undiagnosed due to a lack of funding. She told us that epilepsy rates were high and asked, "Why is epilepsy high?" And she said that it's to do with schistosomiasis getting into the brain, and that causes epileptic-like symptoms. And I asked her, why is schistosomiasis so common? And she said it's a waste disposal and sanitation problem. And back on mental health, she was very open to discuss it, and it was so refreshing. And she said there's definitely need for education and awareness in order to remove this stigma so that people can talk more openly about mental health and that those who need help can get it. And this thing about widespread health education was brought up so many times. Whether it was that people said things and you wondered if they could benefit from more education, or whether it was that people themselves said, "We don't know about this and we want to learn." One of the ladies I spoke to said she doesn't give her children paracetamol as she's afraid her children will be allergic to it. Sometimes Barangay health workers describe this fear that had been generated by Dengvaxia and how it's led to decreased vaccinations. And then because of this decrease in immunisation, the measles cases have gone up in the area. So people would really benefit, obviously, from further education. And I know the Barangay health workers are involved in kind of counselling about the vaccination to help people get their children vaccinated. And a nurse told me that sometimes mothers will keep one children's antibiotics, and then when the other child gets sick, they'll use those old antibiotics on them. And the nurse said, "I tell them they can't do this." And so yeah, this need for education was definitely echoed in every healthcare professional that we met. One doctor from Manila discussed the need to kind of move upstream and implement effective health promotion campaigns. They also discussed the need to implement health protective policies. So he said that currently cigarettes are sold in small quantities. So if you can't afford to buy a whole big pack, you can just buy a few little cigarettes. So obviously, perhaps if you could only sell cigarettes in packs, this would maybe deter those who couldn't afford it from buying cigarettes, potentially. And the doctor also said that the banning of smoking in public areas could be more consistent. So it just kind of highlighted the need for all systems to try and get on board just that little bit more if it's possible. But there was this fantastic program I heard about called the 4Ps Conditional Cash Transfer. So many of the mothers I spoke to were using this. And it basically aims to break the cycle of poverty by keeping children under the age of 18 healthy and in school so that they can have a better future. So households receive money in kind of regular instalments so that their children stay in school. So there's like conditions that the parents have to adhere to get the cash transfer. And so they have to get regular health checkups. They have their growth monitored, receive vaccines, things like that. Pregnant women must get the prenatal care that they're required to get. And the births need to be attended by professional healthcare workers. So obviously they shift away from kind of the use of HELOTs and things, really trying to drive that. Parents to get the CCT must also go to monthly community-based family development sessions to learn about positive child discipline, disaster preparedness, and also women's rights. So this is just a wonderful initiative that's out there for those who need it. Despite kind of the hardships that everyone had faced, the people I met were just so happy. They would randomly just sing or dance. They were always joking around. It was never a dull moment. It was an absolute pleasure to be around them and learn about their culture. This importance of gathering together and bonding over a meal is something I noticed and really enjoyed actually being a part of, chatting about our day over some lovely warm food. It was great to learn about their celebrations and fiestas that I've mentioned before. So they're really common in Samoa, and people get together, dance, sing, have alcohol, have sweet food. But actually, barangay health workers said that it's often after fiestas that people can present with type 2 diabetes. So this was interesting to see the impact of culture on health. But yeah, the people, they had such a strong sense of community and of family, and their connectedness to each other was just brilliant. And their energy was just contagious, really. It just passed from them to me. And it was so inspirational to be around. They were just so resilient. And that was just kind of a reminder to be grateful for life's blessings and kind of appreciate the beauty of simple things. It sounds cheesy, but it's, once you've been in that experience, it is so true. And it just gave me like a great empathy for those who didn't have the opportunities or resources that they maybe should. There was people who'd obviously faced such hardships. So they'd had their homes destroyed by typhoons, or they'd lost their children, or their children had been paralysed. One woman's son had fell from a coconut tree and unfortunately been paralysed and was then kind of dependent on her. And another woman had lost a loved one in the eye of a storm. But they were just still such wonderful people to be around. And it seemed as though kind of the challenges that they'd been exposed to had made them stronger. Just to talk about what I expected Samoa to be like. Going there, I almost thought it would be like the film Avatar, which I absolutely love. But kind of like you dropped in into an entirely different universe. So unfamiliar. You're in your own little bubble. Where I would observe all of these differences and ways of life. Oh, it's going to be so different. Almost like you're separate to what you're observing, which is just not how ethnography works at all. Because it's, you know, in order to have that successful ethnographic research, you need to just totally really integrate and just be so open, which was what was just so wonderful. But I hadn't imagined it like that in my mind. Because initially you'll arrive and things will strike you like, I remember with us, it was, where are we going to sleep? Or where's the flush on the toilet? It's just different to your normal routine. So it kind of stands out for like the first hour. But it's surprising how quickly you adapt. And what was normal to you, like your bed or the flush on the toilet, all those things that were normal are forgotten. Because actually, once you've washed twice using the scoop and scooping the water from the well, having a splash and getting yourself clean that way from the barrel instead, and not flushing the toilet, you forget all about baths and flushes and sleeping in a bed. And I remember when I came home back to the UK after spending that time away in the Philippines, I had a bath and it was actually quite strange. And I was now used to using the scoops of water from the well to wash. And that was my new normal. So it took actually a few days to settle back into home. And what had obviously been my home in the UK, after being in the Philippines, my home in the UK was now foreign to me. So that was a very strange sensation, but very interesting. And that made me realise that all of those obvious differences, like, ooh, sleeping differences, toilet differences, they're actually not really true differences at all. And it just reinforced what I'd thought on the trip as I'd spent time with people about how similar we all are. So beyond these kind of gimmicky things, like the obvious toilet flush, the obvious bed, the washing with the scoop, there was just people who cared for their parents and their grandparents, just like how I do. There was people who cared greatly for their friends. There was people who'd suffered bereavements and experienced loss and tragedy. There was children playing and laughing together outside, just being silly like as children do. And I just thought how similar we all are. And it just highlighted the importance of supporting others in the world and working together as a global community who strive for equality, not only in healthcare, but also in education, in access to services and in the distribution of resources. So, yeah, very, very good. I'm going to wrap up by playing a recording from one of my favourite days on the trip. My own experience of seeing the extraordinariness of ordinary things. So we were on this particular island and the barangay health workers were showing us all of the medicinal plants native to the island. We'd been wandering around exploring for quite some time that day and it was now like kind of approaching a lovely sunset in the sky. We were walking down a path and on either side of it there was beautiful bright green grass with lovely plants and flowers. The ocean was on our right-hand side and there were little boats just floating so peacefully in the water and there were small houses on our left and along the fences outside people's houses they had clothes which they'd obviously laid out earlier to dry in the sun and they were just colourful, decorating the fence almost like bunting. And some of the local children just wandered along and came and joined us on our walk and they were walking beside me and they were smiling and chatting and just being silly as children do. And I felt so welcome on this island and it was so calming, such a calming environment to be in. And as we walked, you could hear, obviously karaoke is such a massive deal. You could hear Celine Dion being sung on karaoke, the Titanic song, My Heart Will Go On, echoing from someone's home. So I've got a clip of it and I'm going to play it and fingers crossed you can hear it. So, yeah, that was a cheeky bit of karaoke that we heard. And it was just so lovely. The children were walking with us. The karaoke was just singing. It was so nice. The wind was blowing. It was just absolutely lovely. And it was my favourite day of the whole trip. So I'm going to finish with a quote from Olive Wendell Holmes that is, "A mind that is stretched by new experiences can never go back to its old dimensions." Now, how true this quote is. So I'd like to say thank you to Solace for this wonderful opportunity because being a part of this ethnographic research has, for sure, no doubt, changed the way I look at the world. And it's given me kind of a new lens with which to view the human condition and a new way to view what we would call ordinary. So thank you to the funders, the Arts and Research Humanities Council and the Medical Research Council Global Challenges Research Fund who made this wonderful interdisciplinary research possible. Just fantastic to support it and it was just brilliant to be a part of. Thank you to my fellow Solace student ambassadors. That's Harriet Howells, Danielle Wyan, Syra Battelio. They made the experience just so phenomenal and they have fantastic brains and energies and that was brilliant. Thank you so much to Dr. Lisa Dikomitis, the Solace Principal Investigator. Lisa is just a powerhouse. She's a force of nature. We've been so fortunate to have Lisa educate us and inspire us. So thank you so much, Lisa. Thank you, Issa Miharis, the project manager from Ateneo University. It was so lovely spending time with you. Dr. Joel Kanudai, thank you so much for his wisdom, his kindness on the trip. Again, just so knowledgeable and brilliant to be around. I'd like to also give a shout out to our surrogate family in Samos. That's Miss Cherry Alphalair, Mr. Miguel Alberto, Matthew McTangai, Chinchin Luto, Doc Fonzie, Miss Issa Banyas, also Doc Sean, Mam Juj from Health Sci and Ateneo. Also, thank you so much to Andrew Hassel from Keele Medical School for allowing us to go on this wonderful adventure. And thank you to everyone in Northern Samoa who was just so open to us. Every single person we met, they just welcomed us into their communities and their homes and made the experience what it was. So salamat po to them. Thank you so much.
Solis is jointly funded by the Arts and Humanities and Medical Research Council in the United Kingdom. Solis is one of the Global Challenges Research Projects and is led by Dr. Lisa Decomites at Keele University. For more information, please visit the Solis website at www.solace-research.com. That's www.solace-research.com, or follow us on Twitter @solace_research.